Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews, presenting the film scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The film scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts, featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Why, hello, everyone. Welcome to the film scene. I am Ileana Douglas. I'm here with Jeff Graham. Hello, Jeff.
I'm not looking as festive as you are, Ileana. I dropped the ball here.
I did the full... This is from the 80s.
Yes.
This was my grandmother's and then my mom's, and now it's mine.
It's great. If favorite. I may, it's very good with your eyes. It really brings out the color.
The green.
Yes.
This is my Christmas, my go-to, and the leggings.
Yes.
I've got the velvety leggings.
And the boots, I got to say.
And it's the boots, right?
Yes.
Show off my dancing skills.
It's very impressive, yes. For our podcast listeners, you'll have to check out the YouTube video to see what may be the most festive outfit of the year. It's great.
Are you into ugly? What do you wear on Christmas morning?
Oh, man, I'm like such... I'd like to think of myself as, like, you know, kind of intellectual. I take myself seriously. But around the holidays, I am like onesie, wake up. If it's not a onesie, it's Christmas PJs. I love just like enter. I'm so earnest about the holidays. Like, I love, like, on even on Thanksgiving, I wake up and I watch the Macy's Day Parade, like, right when it starts.
Yeah.
I'm just, you can't bring the Ohio out of me. Like, I'm just like a casserole eating, like, holiday lover, you know?
I think that's great. Well, I've got that Connecticut, New England thing.
Yeah.
So I too have that. Got to go out in the snow for a little bit. But New Englanders pride themselves on shoveling their own driveway.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that a big thing in Ohio?
Totally. I mean, my wife and I talk about this. We're both from the Midwest. She's from Indiana. I'm from Ohio. And we talk about there's just no character building chore element to living in Los Angeles.
You're right.
So if we start a family here, how are we going to discipline our kids when the weather's always perfect?
You're
there's
right.
There's no leaves.
Yes. And in fact, that's a big couple bonding thing.
Totally.
Is getting out of the snow.
Yep. Raking the
leaves.
Somebody's
got to drive where you push the car.
Oh my gosh. Scraping the car. There's not enough inconveniences in this city, which is a very privileged sentence to say, but how do you build character in your kiddos?
You're right. That's when I was a kid, we didn't have a lot of money, and so we couldn't afford an antenna for the house. So we only got one channel, which was CBS. And then my mom thought she'd surprise us one Christmas, so she bought the $20 antenna, but she didn't buy the rotor, you know, which was in the old days the rotor was the thing on the television that moved the antenna, so
could
get the different. I know, see, you're so young, you don't even remember what a rotor is.
You know what, I feel like early stages of my life, I remember.
It was it was this gigantic box, and it was, you turned it, it went, and it turned the antenna. But,
nice.
But my mom didn't buy that. And so we had a ladder. We had an old colonial house, and so we had a ladder on the side of the house. And I kid you not, one of my brothers would lean out the window, and I'd scramble up to the roof, and I would turn it, you know, so we could watch Mork and Mindy or something.
I love it.
And then scramble back down, and of course you'd be watching it, and invariably the wind would blow, and it'd be like, you know, you'd lose the channel and be back to CBS. So I only sporadically saw other channels. I mainly saw CBS.
Nice.
But it made me appreciate Christmas, something like that. All right. Let's talk about movies. I'm very excited. I saw Uncut Gems last night. I was at the premiere.
I am dying to see this movie. It sounds like Take a Xanax Before You Go.
Here's my tip. I went with my friend Wayne Fetterman, who, if anybody wants to check, he's a dead ringer for Daniel Goldman, the Dems prosecutor. Look at Adam. Oh my God, Adam Sandler. But anyway, you need it. It's really a guy movie.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. A packed house, great way to see it. And, but I just kept grabbing Wayne and like, oh God, please, please make it stop. Why is he doing these things? So it has, I spoke to the filmmakers afterwards. And I said, I definitely sensed a kind of a Michael Mann thief vibe, the James Caan movie, also the Dustin Hoffman movie called Straight Time. So it's got that vibe of the 70s, just an incredible performance. Very disturbing, very gritty, but very, very interesting. And, you know, one of the main things I liked about it, aside from it being a very good, compelling movie, it was a world I knew nothing about.
Mm.
And I always, you know, sometimes like, okay, it's gonna be another movie about this. But I was riveted because I don't know anything about the Diamond District in New York City.
It's like black market jewelry, right, is the world we're in for this film?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and jewels, and it's very disturbing.
Yeah, these filmmakers are so – these are the Safdie brothers who in some ways kind of feel like our generation's Coens maybe.
Uh-huh.
Different types of movies, but I think in the same way that the Coens do genre movies with like an elegance, I think the Safdies do the same thing where, you know, they're kind of putting together straight-ahead thrillers, but with these kind of weird, quirky elements that sort of elevates the genre.
Well, you know what I love about it is a lot is done with the lighting and with the shots without the camera going insane. You know, I could actually follow the story. There's some fantastic intercutting between scenes, which really adds to some of the tension. There are a couple sort of cinematic surprises, a couple laughs in there, well needed. But I thought the look of it was really good. But I just didn't know what was going to happen in the next minute. And so I guess that, for me, it kept me on the edge of the seat. And I was up all night thinking about it. So you can't get Adam Sandler out of your head after watching the movie. So I highly recommend it. It's just an interesting film. So
it's interesting, too. I think there's, like, celebrity cameos in it, right? Like, isn't Kevin Garnett, like, a major player? How does he do?
Excellent.
Really?
There's a lot of non-actors. That was the question I asked them, too. There's a couple people are so good in the film, and that's why I leaned over. I said, if that person's an actor, you know, I would be shocked. And so sure enough, there's a lot of people in the film that are not actors, but do a really great job. And again, this goes back to the editing and the directing. They did tell me they went through a number of cuts of the film.
Oh, wow. It
took them 10 years to make the movie. And they went through a lot of cuts and to get what they, you know, what the final outcome was. Great movie to see in a theater, though, I would say, as opposed to seeing it.
Well, while you talk about cuts, if they ever want to do like their own director's cut, they can call it Uncut Gems, the Uncut Gem version, and release it for all of us to enjoy.
Well, I also have to throw credit because I said, the movie started in the music. I said, oh, I got a little bit of Tangerine Dream and, you know, Michael Mann, the thief. And he goes, man's the man. I was like, okay, that's pretty cool.
There you go. Same wavelength.
So that, and then you saw Marriage Story.
Now, I finally saw it.
Okay, last week I was ranting that, you know, movies were too long, which I feel that they're a little bit too long. I saw a movie, Honey Boy.
Yes.
96 minutes. Perfect. Really good movie. I thought it was very interesting, very compelling, stayed with me. Another one I recommend, you know, so 96 minutes is fine for a film. So what did you think of Marriage Story?
I thought Marriage Story, I'm going to be honest, was pretty perfect. I think it might be one. I'm not going to call it a masterpiece. I'm going to avoid the M word from our discussion from last year, but I loved it. Ryan was mentioning before we went on air that I'm writing a little something for our Popcorn Talk website. It's a little op-ed about my take on the movie.
Okay.
Despite the fact that it is like a courtroom divorce film, I found it to be a very romantic movie in a very kind of strange way. I think it's one of the most romantic movies I saw this year. And I think it has to do with the fact that when you see the couple, you know, they're separating. It's a divorce movie. But when you see them interact before lawyers and courts get involved, there's an affection and an intimacy in their relationship. And it's not until there's litigation that it really drives them apart.
Right.
I almost feel like the movie's talking about the industry of divorce. I heard a critic talking about the idea of like the divorce industrial complex.
Yes.
How it's designed to make people money, but throughout that process, destroy relationships.
I think that's all valid. I mean, I would also say that didn't Kramer versus Kramer handle that same subject.
It did. But the thing with Kramer versus Kramer, and I do love that movie.
Howard Duff.
Yeah, I love the performances, but I feel like you don't get to see the intimacy or affection of the relationship as much. I think what I like, and I thought was generous that Baumbach gave us in this movie, was we get a couple scenes, like this scene where they're closing the security gate, when you can really see the aching love that these two still have for each other, kind of buried beneath all of the pain. That's how I read it.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I'm going to mention another film that is one of my favorite films, which is called Shoot the Moon.
Mm.
And Shoot the Moon is a film that I really loved, and I felt like that was my childhood.
Wow.
You know, there were more kids in that film. I think there were three kids.
Mm.
And that movie took it a step further in that not only were they getting a divorce, but, you know, she was embarking on a new relationship, and that is a very messy and at times violent film.
I can't wait to see it.
And that was like the ripping apart of a relationship. This couple, although, again, I thought the acting was great. You know, I enjoyed the film. I just thought, you know, they barely, to me, it was more about a couple that got married and didn't really know each other.
Mm.
You know, I mean, they were barely married before they were getting a divorce. How old is the kid?
That's a really interesting take, too. And they kind of refused to let them see each other. You know, I think that's a really interesting point, is maybe that's what the movie is saying, is by the time they finally let themselves see each other, it was too late.
Yeah.
You know?
And the other thing that just bothered me, is just a little critique, was that it felt awfully convenient that he was a very rich, successful person who could fly, you know, to California, and she very conveniently was a successful actress.
It's true.
So I didn't really see what the problem was. You know, I was like, I wasn't really
fine.
Like my childhood where, you know, people are going to court and fighting over child support. And
The I feel like the device of a MacArthur Genius Grant. I've seen that in movies before.
Oh,
where,
so many times.
I know. If you want to make sure
Cameron
someone's
Jenkins
smart.
Cameron Jenkins used it in The Savages.
The Savages, yeah. I will say Private Life last year. It was a movie not enough people talked about. Did you like Private Life?
Yes.
That might be my favorite movie of last year, and I feel like it got no love. I love Tamara Jenkins as a director, but so often we see the MacArthur Genius Grant just show up as a way to tell us that someone is smart, you know? It's a funny trope that I'm seeing more
so
and more.
That is so interesting. You're right.
Yeah.
If you're going to call out movies from last year, one of my absolute favorite movies from last year, because we're going to get into women directors, Land of Steady Habits.
Oh, I didn't see it, but I heard it was beautiful.
Nicole Hofstetter is one of my absolute favorite directors. I think she's a genius.
Yeah.
I love anything she's ever done. I just think she's a terrific filmmaker. And that film, for me, was a great, really, really interesting film. Again, about a marriage.
Yeah.
About the breakdown.
I can't wait to see it.
Of a marriage, but that I related to more. I just didn't. I mean, again, I'm going to switch over to the Honey Boy. I just, Uncut Gems, I personally like movies where the people are a little bit more complex.
Mm.
Movies about rich people and their problems, I chafe just a little bit.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. I find it a little bit harder to get into the story.
That's fair.
I don't know if that's my own upbringing or, you know, I like people that are a little bit more complex.
Yeah.
You know, that are in a predicament. And how did they get in this predicament? And how am I rooting for them to get out of it? In this particular case, like the fact that a marriage failed after 4 years because they didn't really know each other when they got involved,
right.
The amount of screaming that was, you know, that was screaming at each other, it verged for me on more like acting class. What I call acting class acting.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, sometimes when you're in a movie, I've done this too, you really go for it and you go, okay, great, I got that out of my system. Now let me modulate the performance. And, you know, there were times that I would have, you know, just because you can cry and emote, it doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna touch the performer. And so I think as a director, you really have to, that's something, emotion, you have to be very, very careful of, I think, of, you know, of that on screen. I'd love to know other people's, what they think of Shoot the Moon, which is, that is disturbing. I mean, my parents' divorce was just, you know, was like more like Shoot the Moon. Mm. Was more like, you know, they were really angry at each other, and this seemed to be very nice. Like, I'd love to have a very, you know, wealthy, sophisticated, you know, lawyer helping you out, and it all seemed, you know, pretty great. Anyway, it's an interesting movie. Let's before we're going to talk about Christmas movies with Alonzo Duralde. Mm-hmm. But before that, just let's briefly say that, yes, it's a disappointment with everything that female film directors have accomplished. Still, it's embarrassing that there are no female directors nominated for the Golden Globes. Absolutely a shame. And in fact, I made a point of mentioning that there a bunch of films were put into the Library of Congress, mm-hmm. among them Elaine May's A New Leaf, which is 1971. In the Hollywood Reporter, it says the first film directed and starring a woman. It is now this is a misnomer that I was taught my entire life. You know, when we did Trailblazing Women for TCM, women were making studio films, turn of the century, you know, that they wrote, produced, and started. Maybe they were in a 2-hour, you know, but to say that it wasn't a studio film, they were studio films because they were working for studios. Alice Guy Blaschet, we had Pam Green on here, ran her own studio. Therefore, that is a studio film. So, if you want to get into modern filmmaking, and if you want to say that the first modern filmmaker was Barbara Loden, who in 1970 made a film called Wanda. She wrote, produced, directed, and starred in it. It's a Criterion release, so people may want to check it out. So, as much as I love Elaine May and champion A New Leaf, she is not the first filmmaker. And so, again, we get these credits wrong so many times. And even within the credits, it's like, gee, isn't it unbelievable? She's the first woman in 1970, you know, like, they finally let this woman make the movie. And again, it's a misnomer. Women were always making films, writing, producing, editing films. So sorry to get on my soapbox.
Well, it buries decades of history, you know? It's
because
crazy.
It makes it insignificant. And again, coming, you know, with the same thing with the Golden Globe, here's all these, some of the great films directed by women this year: Booksmart, Honey Boy, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, The Farewell. Mm. I'm sure I'm forgetting a bunch of others, but all, you know, amazing films. And you know what the Golden Globe's response was? You know, that, well, maybe there should be a different category. It's women's movies? Like, that's what we used to say. A chick, I thought we were... They're saying like women, like, yeah, like, let's make a special category, you know, like an inferior category.
Yeah, that's the implication.
And then the other complaint was, yeah, but women get to do a lot of things on TV. That was the other. What are these women complaining about? Get back in the kitchen. Right. It's so.
They can watch the Great British Bake Off.
These stereotypes, they're so baked in, you know. Yeah. And that you find yourself, again, just sort of shaking your head. Stereotype. Women have always made movies. It's not a revelation. Women didn't suddenly, in the 70s, start to make movies. They were there at the beginning. Stereotype number one. Stereotype, you know, number two. There does not need to be a special category for films directed by women. All of the movies that I... You know, so if you saw Honey Boy, you would not know if a man directed it or a woman directed it. You know,
and
it's really challenging. You know, we make steps forward and then we go backwards because of, you know, what people read. That's what I think anyway. All right. Well, enough of that. Let's talk about Christmas movies and bring in Alonzo Duralde here. It's Christmas morning. I'm mouthing off. Alonso is a critic expert on Christmas films. He was the artistic director at the USA Film Festival Dallas for 5 years. He's also the former arts and entertainment editor at the National Gay and Lesbian Magazine. He became a senior film critic for The Wrap, which also syndicates his reviews for Reuters. He appears on the TYT Network, What the Flick, co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. His first book, 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, was published. Duralde was featured in writer Dennis Hensley's book. And your second book, which is out now, I'm going to hold it up, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, published in October by Limelight Editions, available on Amazon. We know how much book sales are important to us. But thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. This is a treat.
And you look very festive. You've got your Christmas.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Sort of.
I know. I would have gone red if I'd known you were doing green, but I think this worked either way.
So we're going to do Christmas movies, but it is a tradition on the show. Do you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
I do. Well, I'm the youngest of seven, so
wow.
my oldest sister is 13 years older than I am, and she and her high school boyfriend took me to see Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Aww.
In its original release. Which scarred me for life and turned me into a lifelong movie fan, I think.
Now, which part, like watching the kids get sucked into?
That tunnel scene, you know, there's a chicken that gets beheaded and there's a worm crawling across somebody's face. Like, that is for a G-rated movie. That's really pushing it. But,
yes.
An iguana, too, right? I think.
Eating a bug. Yeah.
Very unsettling.
It's funny. The 70s and 80s ratings were just sort of like a suggestion.
Yes. I know. I grew up. Did you see? I remember on television they would have all the portrait of a teenage alcoholic.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
All the getting into drugs movies.
The whole Linda Blair cycle.
Yes, which only made you feel like if you left school you'd end up in prison.
Yeah, or you'd hitchhike and get picked up by a serial killer.
No. So with your Christmas book that's out now, I mean, again, I guess I got to ask were you a fan of Christmas?
Yes, very much so. Again, big family, so that was always a great time of year. And also, I think the age difference plays in because Christmas was when everybody came home, because I was still, knocking around while everybody else was off in college or whatever. I've always loved Christmas. I've always loved movies. And I think inevitably it was, I was going to have to bring the two together.
Well, seven kids, that must be an all day. My God.
Oh, yeah. It's an event. And, nowadays it's a major troop movement because, we're all married. Most of us have kids. It's it's a whole thing.
Oh, that's sounds fun. And do you have any, you have your go-to family? Because everything, what's great about the book is it's divided. You even have, as I was saying to you before we started, the worst. I love that you have the worst. Because sometimes you go, I can't watch It's a Wonderful Life one more time.
Yeah,
or can you?
Oh, I manage.
You can watch it every year.
Well, because we live in L.A. and they project it every year, which is great. So, we'll troop out to the Arrow in Santa Monica and see it. And that's become, part of one of the stops, on the Christmas tour. But, yeah, I was seeing some terrible ones and some really, beautifully, brilliantly terrible ones. And I was like, yeah, we need to – got to toss those in for variety. But, yeah, the book kind of – I think the idea is that whatever kind of movies you like, there's a Christmas movie that fits your niche.
Yeah.
If you're a horror person, if you like action, if you want a tearjerker or a comedy or whatever, or even if you want a terrible movie, there's Christmas on offer.
And It's a Wonderful Life has an interesting history because it wasn't necessarily a hit film when it came out.
Yeah, it pretty much bankrupted Frank Capra's production company that he had started. This was the first movie that he and Jimmy Stewart made coming back from World War II.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Stewart, we now know from biographies, was suffering from PTSD during the shoot. And you can really, there are moments in the performance where that comes through. But I think that's interesting because that movie for him becomes the pivot point between pre-war sort of aw shucks Jimmy Stewart to the Anthony Mann, Otto Preminger Jimmy Stewart, Vertigo Jimmy Stewart that we'd be getting not long after. But yeah, so it tanked, it went into the public domain. And then that's why, when we were coming up, it was constantly on television because it was free. And I think, now you have those 24-hour Christmas story marathons, and I'm pretty sure those are designed to they got the idea from It's a Wonderful Life by accident because It's a Wonderful Life was just always on. Like, it would end on one channel, and you'd flip over, and it'd be, two-thirds of the way through somewhere else.
Right. When I was growing up, I remember them. You know, there would be It's a Wonderful Life, Meet Me in St. Louis, and The Bishop's Wife. Mm.
And White Christmas.
White Christmas, right. They'd always play Top Hat on New Year's Eve. Did you know? That used to, I don't know, I just have a memory, because I would be with my relatives, Italian relatives, and they'd be upstairs banging pots, and I would be downstairs watching, you know.
Doing the Continental.
Fred Astaire. I guess they feel like it's sophisticated.
Exactly. Yeah, we're dressed up, you know, a New Year's thing.
Yeah, a New Year's thing. But I remember, I think it was in the late 80s, there was a book that came out called like the making of It's a Wonderful Life, and that was the first time that I sort of I felt that they were considering Christmas movies as sort of artistic, like, oh, there actually may be a theme here.
Yeah, I think for the most part, you know, they're sort of looked upon as, there's either good movies that happen to be Christmas movies that you like for whatever reason. But I don't think anybody's really sort of taken it seriously as a genre. And I mean, and this isn't an academic book. You know, I'm not like, there aren't footnotes. I'm not getting deep into this. But, you know, I just think that what I think is cool about it is that, you know, we think of the It's a Wonderful Life and the White Christmases and that kind of thing as the sort of obvious go-tos. But when you start digging a little and you say, oh, well, you know, Eyes Wide Shut is a Christmas movie, you know, or Metropolitan or The Lion in Winter. You know, these are Christmas movies. And people kind of take a step back and go, oh, yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, sure. And so it sort of expands the definition.
Well, plus, because you can, you know, you can have your own sort of film festival.
Absolutely.
At home throughout the holidays. You don't have to keep, you know, watching the same one. So I want to talk about some of the more obscure ones.
Oh, sure.
Because there were ones that I even hadn't. What was the Deanna Durbin one that you mentioned?
Oh, Christmas Holiday. Yeah,
Christmas Holiday. So tell me about that one.
Which, you know, sadly is in this kind of copyright hell in the U.S., so it's never been released on home video.
Darn.
I know at TCM they want to show it every year, and they just can't get their hands on it. It was a Universal movie. It's a Robert Siodmak noir film. It was Deanna Durbin's first grown-up role. Like, she was, you know, the sort of, you know, juvenile ingenue, but this was her, like, you know, I'm a woman, you know. And so it's based on this Somerset Maugham story, where in the story she's like a singer in a whorehouse. In the movie they keep it kind of vague. It's like, you know, it's a hotel or something. But basically, it's that this guy, this GI, gets written a Dear John letter. He wants to go home for Christmas to confront his ex-fiance, but the plane gets stuck in New Orleans. He meets Deanna Durbin's character, takes her to Mass, learns her tale of woe, where she'd been married to this guy who seemed charming but turned out to be like a compulsive gambler and had this mommy fixation. That guy is played by Gene Kelly. So you've got Gene Kelly and Deanna Durbin in this like really dark noir film, which is super antithetical to anything they ever did. And it's really terrific. And, and I wish more people could see it. And I'm holding out hope that one of these years they'll clear up whatever the legal problem is. Because I had to get a DVD out of the UK to even watch it.
Wow.
Wow. That would be, that was a good one. Now, another great thing you have is I love all the fun facts that you have. That's a great, you know, so you can read the movie and you can see things about where the location was. One of the things I liked was that the film Christmas in Connecticut and Bringing a Baby used the same set.
Yeah, the outside of the farmhouse.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, and then also, like,
how did you notice? You just noticed it?
No. I read it somewhere. Oh. Like, the Academy Library, a very helpful resource if you live in LA. Like, they've got everything. Also found out that the neighbor's house, I think, in Christmas Vacation, that's on the Warner Ranch, was Danny Glover's house in Lethal Weapon.
Which is also
a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I think I read that one. Now, what about this movie? This sounded so, I've never heard of this movie. Trapped in Paradise.
Ah,
1994. Written and directed by George Gallo.
Yes.
Who had a very promising start. Nick Cage, John Lovitz, Dana Carvey, Meechan Amick.
Yeah.
And it's Fox.
Yeah, it's a comedy where Cage, Lovitz, and Dana Carvey. Yeah, there we go.
I want to see it.
Yeah, they play siblings. Nicolas Cage is the one who's sort of trying to go straight, but they're all kind of like have criminal backgrounds. And so Lovitz and Carvey get like a Christmas furlough out of prison.
Right.
And they overheard some guy wanting to like do a bank job in this tiny little town. So Cage gets dragged along to do the bank job. And then, of course, they can't leave. There's like just one complication after another. And of course, the longer they say, it's one of those little towns where they fall in love with everybody and then they feel bad about having stolen their money and, you know, complications ensue.
Oh, okay.
And their mother is played by Anne Ramsey from Throw Mama from the Train.
Oh, the great Anne Ramsey. And you said we were talking about Quick Change, but you said it's got that vibe of Quick Change.
Kind of, yeah, in terms of just the sort of like absurdist caper movie. You know?
Now, wait a minute. Why is Lady in the Lake? Come on. Why
that's totally Christmas. Have you seen it lately?
Not in a while.
The opening credits are all on Christmas cards. There's a great scene where like Audrey Totter is like standing next to a Christmas tree holding a gun. It's the whole thing is set at Christmas.
I guess I thought so much of just the weirdness of them looking
at the first person. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let me look at the fun facts. But yeah, with the Christmas cards, I like that. Ames is known for being the father in Meet Me in St. Louis. Right, the guy first movie told from the point of view.
So the for people who don't know the film, it's Robert Montgomery as which is it Sam is it Philip Marlowe or
Well, it's by Raymond Chandler, so he must be Marlowe.
He's Philip Marlowe, and the premise of the film is that the camera is Philip Marlowe.
Yeah.
So everybody is talking to the camera. It's all directly first person.
Yeah.
The only time you hear Robert Montgomery's voice throughout.
Tree.
Yeah. See.
I love it.
But you know,
I never realized.
You only see Robert Montgomery in the mirror.
Yes. Finally, you see him in the one. I have the poster.
Oh wow!
Very disturbing. Where he's like, that's the I have that poster.
Oh nice. It's very gimmicky, but it's a cool idea, and you know it's almost an experimental film in a way.
You have Go in there.
Yeah,
John August, right? Is that his first screenplay? I think
this is directed by Doug Liman.
Yeah, John August wrote it. Yes.
John August.
He wrote that on spec, and now he's like John August. But
and giving gigs to Melissa McCarthy from the get go. That's one of her first.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. This one's very interesting. Do you have? Isn't the ice storm? Is the ice storm a Christmas movie or no? It's just the snow.
I think it's just winter.
Just the snow.
Do you have specific criteria that like this can count?
Oh,
or,
good
like,
question.
Oh, yeah. You know, I leave that up to folks because I get asked all the time. Like this year, people were like, "Oh, well, is Hustlers a Christmas movie?" Because there's one big scene that's set at Christmas, and you know, somebody asked if The Irishman was. I'm like, well, if you think it is, sure. I mean, because I have
good
female
fellas.
Trouble in there. There you go. I have female. Trouble in there, which really just has the one scene early on where she doesn't get the cha-cha heels for Christmas and she dumps the Christmas tree on her parents, and that's it. But it's such an iconic scene that I included anyway, you know. So I think sometimes you get movies where Christmas happens, but only because they want to show the passage of time, and that's just an easy way to say December.
Right.
But, you know, if for you think of that moment as being Christmassy, then absolutely. I mean, there are people who think of The Sound of Music as a Christmas movie just because they would always watch it with their family at Christmas time, even though there's not a second of Christmas in it. So, you know, far be it for me to, like, you know, canonize anything. But for me, generally, it's sort of like if there's at least one specific moment that's very Christmassy, if there's a sense of Christmas throughout the film, if it affects the plot in any way. Like, I've always defended Die Hard as a Christmas movie because, you know, the fact that the party is happening on Christmas Eve is part of the plan. You know, the building's going to be empty. There's not going to be people in the streets. You know, and on another level, it's a movie about a husband and wife who reconcile on Christmas Eve. Mm. And her name is Holly. Come on.
this is one of my – I love this movie, Nobody's Fool.
Oh, so great.
That is such an underrated film with a fantastic soundtrack.
One of the last, maybe the last Jessica Tandy movie. Definitely late Paul Newman and late Robert Benton.
I think that's what you say. And then you said, this threw me. Newman and Willis had worked together previously. The latter had been a bit player in The Verdict.
Yes.
How'd you find that? How did you
research?
See, sometimes it's like you just be watching something. Like I was watching the movie Francis Farmer, and I'm like, wait a minute, is it Kevin Costner? Is it extra? You know? And then
wow,
yeah. And then when I did a movie with him, I said, I've seen a lot of your work, specifically
Francis.
So it's fun to rib people that way, you know. But no, I didn't know that. So now I want to look at, you know, And I love that film.
And a great Bruce Willis performance and a very early Philip Seymour Hoffman appearance.
Yeah, very. Paul Newman is fantastic in it. And again, one of my, you know, that seems to be a hallmark for me of a Christmas movie is the location. And there's a great location.
Yeah, the snowy little town.
They're in upstate New York, right?
Yes. I think. And a great early scene-stealing Margot Martindale appearance.
Oh, yeah, that's
She's the bartender.
Yes, there's all sorts of great little, but I love that town.
Yeah.
And Melanie Griffith is in it.
She's really great in that too.
She's fantastic. Do you think that like Christmas movies explore certain themes? I mean, renewal.
Redemption, I think, is a big
redemption.
One. You know, there's something about Christmas where I think for conflicts, especially within families, there's something about the idea that Christmas is that time that we're going to finally have that conversation that clears the air, or we're going to decide to forgive somebody, or the thing is going to happen that's going to mend, you know, this broken relationship.
Yeah.
And there's something ineffable about the Christmas season where we think that's when it's going
to
happen.
Yeah. It feels like you have to tread the family Christmas theme. You have to tread very lightly, because there's some movies like Once Around, which I really love.
Oh, yeah.
But then more recently, like that movie, The Family Stone, it just felt like...
Not a fan.
it's just... You want to get behind. I mean, I feel like a Christmas movie, you inherently want to get behind.
Sure.
I don't know why.
Well, I do, definitely. But
defend the Family Stone personally.
Yes.
I want to make it's funny.
It
I love
fans,
it.
No, for,
it, for sure. And I love SJP, but I think it might be... I love a dysfunctional family dramedy, and I feel like
Christmas.
That's my favorite kind of Christmas movie. And the French, I think, do it really well. Like, there was a movie a few years ago called A Christmas Tale with Catherine Deneuve and Mathieu Amalric that I think is great.
Oh, okay.
One called La Bûche that's harder to find, unfortunately, but it's really funny. The Ref, you know, which I have taken a couple years off because I'm not ready to deal with Kevin Spacey again.
I know.
But a great movie otherwise. Richard LeGravenaise wrote and directed that one. I love a bickering family at the holidays. That's my eggnog.
Another theme seems to be love at Christmas.
Sure, well, yeah.
That always is like...
I mean, that's the entire Hallmark network is built upon that idea. You know?
Well, I was trying to think why that is. Is that because that's our hope? I mean, it's tough to be alone at the holidays. It really does... It is when you miss people that are no longer with you. It tugs at your heartstrings.
Well,
you know?
There's a line in a Christmas Carol, something about like, this is the time of year where need is more keenly felt, you know? And I think it's the same thing. It's the same thing with loneliness. Well, because so much of the holiday is about community and family and togetherness. And so if you don't have those things, you're seeing it around you. You're seeing it in TV
commercials. You fixed me. Wait.
Diagnosing Ileana.
But no, I think also the thing about love stories at Christmas is that there's something about Christmas that I think encourages us to be our best selves.
Yes.
And so maybe that our best selves is the one that is open to being vulnerable, that's open to being receptive to love.
I feel that way. Like you watch a movie like Love Actually, but then the problem is you try to really act like that.
It doesn't. Yes, it's tricky to pull off.
Can I help you? People in LA don't seem to
Ma'am, this is an
get as much into, you know, because where I'm from, you're from Ohio, and I'm from, you know, when I go home to New England, it's like you spend 10 minutes talking to the grocer about something and, you know, no one is behind you and irritated.
Well, it never feels like Christmas in L.A. to me. And I'd be interested to hear your take on this, Alonzo.
Well,
but
you know, I grew up in the South. So like I've never had a white Christmas in my life. Yeah. So having an 80 degree Christmas here as opposed to like a 65 degree one at home is like that a huge difference. And one of the things I like about Shane Black is how much he really loves the idea of how artificial an L.A. Christmas is. You look at him and you're like, kiss, kiss, bang, bang, and it's all like palm trees wrapped in twinkle lights and stuff.
Yes. That's the same thing with the movie, which I don't think is in here because it's somewhat problematic, is Reindeer Games, which uses the whole, you know, Christmas, deconstruct it. I've said this before, but one of my favorite DVD commentaries is John Frankenheimer, who does side-by-side scenes of his cut and what they made him do. So
the Shade commentary, then.
It's great.
Much.
It is so. It's really entertaining. It made me like. And I would see his scene, and I'd be like, "Yeah, his scene's better." Like, there was unbelievable, and he'd say, "Here's what they made me do." And then, you know.
I'm kind of surprised that I know there are some that exist, but there haven't been any Southern Hemisphere Christmas movies that have really permeated the American consciousness. And I would love to see a movie, you know, that's set in Australia or New Zealand or Brazil, where everyone is just like sweating and, you know, surfing or whatever, because it's the middle of summer for them. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I love the movies. For me, The Christmas Carol is one of my, we're going to talk about our favorite films later, but I always again, it just has a tie to childhood and watching it on stage. And
yeah.
I just always liked this idea that a ghost would come from your past, make you be a better person. You know,
I have this weird theory that, like, A Christmas Carol, It's a Wonderful Life, and Home Alone are all kind of the same story.
Yeah.
In that people are sort of shown alternate versions of their own life and sort of made to appreciate what they have.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Home Alone, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, like, you know, when the family wishes for the family to go away, and then they do, and then he has to sort of realize what that means, you know.
Right.
So it's sort of like getting that, it's like it's his Pottersville, having the house to himself.
And there is kind of a magical element with Home Alone, with the shoveler kind of guy. He's almost
he's
one of the ghosts that I feel like comes in to, that's interesting.
Somebody made a comment, this year was the 20th anniversary of Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, and somebody wrote a piece saying that it's kind of the horny Christmas Carol, and that you can kind of divide the movie into like past, present, and future for the Tom Cruise character.
That's a movie that I have to revisit. I remember seeing, the first time I saw it, I was stuck in a snowstorm, so I saw it, and actually supposed to be doing a play, and the play was canceled. So I said, well, I guess I'll watch this movie. And then I ended up watching it again because I didn't understand it. And then that was it. That was like, so I feel like I need to revisit
it. Yeah, I think all of his movies get better as time passes.
Right.
Like, I remember when I went opening day here in L.A. and thinking, yeah, give me 20 years and then maybe I'll know what this movie's about. And I feel like I have a little more of a handle on it now.
That's true. That's what Brian De Palma said about Barry Lyndon. Mm-hmm. He said, the first time I saw it, I hated it. And over the years, I've seen it so many times, and now I think it's a masterpiece.
No, absolutely.
Like, it took a lot of, you know, a lot of work. Okay, so then deconstructing Santa is always fun.
Mm.
For me, again, another classic. It's got to be. I do watch Bad Santa.
Yes.
That's a movie my mom likes.
Really?
Oh yeah, my mom. Oh, my wow. Like, so we, and especially now, you know, whoever, if I work with someone, then my mother is like, you know, then she knows the person.
Of course.
He's so good in this movie. I was watching Billy Bob in Bad Santa. And what I love about this movie is, as dark as it is, he does have a little twinkle in his he's got that little slight twinkle in his eye.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The one thing I discovered in researching the movie is there are like three cuts floating around.
Yes.
And
I know.
The director's cut is actually the shortest one. Oh, right, because you worked with Terry Zwigoff.
I know all about the saga of Bad Santa.
Apparently, the director's cut is the shortest one because he wanted to take out every instance where Billy Bob's character was being nice to anybody. So it's the most pungent, you know, the most concentrated version.
And he worked for, I mean, talking to like Kubrick, he worked for like 10 years on his own version of it.
Oh, no kidding.
So interesting. I mean, what I thought was interesting was it was valid. It was a very different film, but that was valid too. But it was a different movie.
Yeah, I think sometimes director's cuts can like fix a movie, or in rare occasions are like, leave well enough alone. But yeah, sometimes it's sort of like, okay, this is just a different interpretation of this. And so I think they both work in their own way, for sure.
Yeah, they have certain similarities. But I happen to love Bad Santa. I just think a really...
The thing about Bad Santa is there is a sense of joy in that film.
Sure.
Like, and do you think that's a precedent for a good Christmas movie? Because even, I would say, the best Christmas horror films still have, like, a wicked mischievousness. Like, something that's still... In my mind, if it's just completely bleak and joyless, it's not necessarily a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't a lot of super hardcore bummers in this category.
Yeah.
I mean, you could point to a movie like, I don't know, Claude Autant-Lara's Deuce from the 40s, which is like, it's all set at Christmas, but it's this very sort of noirish thing about this like maid who's trying to like screw over the people that she works for. And it's fun, but it's bleak, you know?
Yeah.
But even like Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, that Christmas segment at the beginning is so joyous and so luminous. And then it's after it's over that, you know, the things get dark and then it kind of picks up again at the end. But yeah, you're right. It's a hard to do Christmas without giving some glimmer of hope. I mean, I had a hard time writing the horror chapter of this book because I'm such a wimp about horror movies, and I'm the first to admit it. So I could not get through Maniac, which is an 80s kind of cult classic.
When did who got the idea, like, wait a minute, Christmas, dark Christmas? Like, what was the, do you know the first?
Probably the first Black Christmas in 74, which was, you know, Bob Clark, who then went on to make A Christmas Story. I love that. Those are his yin and yang there.
Love it.
Yeah, I think in general, like, for whether it's horror or dark comedies or whatever, there's something about Christmas that feels like the last kind of relatively pure thing, you know, that hasn't been completely commodified or turned into, like, you know, the way Halloween has become the sexy nurse costume holiday.
Right.
There's something relatively innocent about Christmas, so it's very easy to do something diabolical in front of Christmas and make it look even more diabolical.
Mm.
This one's a Christmas Evil.
Yeah, for instance, that's a favorite of John Waters.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's really cool. Brandon Maggart, who is Fiona Apple's father and a Tony winner, plays this guy who is obsessed with Santa and Christmas, and then you know, snaps as you do. It's really quite good. And there's a Blu-ray of it that has the director and John Waters doing a commentary.
Oh, wow. That sounds fun.
Yeah. A thing I recently learned, the guy who made the film was obsessed with the films of Alain Resnais. And he actually went and found, like, one of his cinematographers, I think the guy who shot Stravinsky, and got him to come shoot this movie.
Wow. Okay, that one sounds very interesting, but I'd have to see that with, you know, during the day.
Yeah, with the lights on.
And then you have Gremlins, awesome.
Yeah.
We love Joe Dante.
We love Joe.
There's a movie called Silent Night. Silent Night, Deadly Night is the slash movie everybody knows.
Okay.
Silent Night, Bloody Night, I'd never heard of until doing
never
the research.
Never heard of it.
Mary Warrenov and her then husband made it together.
Uh-huh.
And it has all these, like, Warhol factory people in it. There's, like, there's a scene that's like a flashback back to sort of an orgy in a madhouse or something. I forget exactly what it is, but like Ondine is in it and all these other sort of Warhol factory folks who, you know, I guess they had in their Rolodex. It's a cool, it feels like one of those, we were talking, you know, those 70s made for TV movies, not so much the Sarah T, but the those really kind of bleak low budget horror movies where it's always like this house in the middle of nowhere. And it was always, you know, like the sky is slate gray and maybe there's a ghost, you know?
Yeah, this one sounds interesting. It sounds very arty.
It is.
And then you have Silent Night, Deadly Night. That's 1984.
Has like four or five sequels.
Yeah, that was the big... There's like a Dark Christmas movie out this year, I think.
There's a Black Christmas remake, actually. It's coming out this week.
So there's a lot.
And I'm excited about that one because April Wolf, who was a film critic for a long time and we used to co-host a podcast together, is the co-writer on it. So.
Okay, I never heard of this. Whoever Slew Auntie Rue? That sounds like a Monkees episode.
It's Shelley Winters.
Oh my God, we love Shelley Winters.
And it's basically a take on the Hansel and Gretel story.
Wow.
With the kid, is it the kid from Oliver, I think, right? Mark Lester?
It's directed by Curtis Harrington, starring Shelley Winters. Mark Lester, yes.
Yeah, the kid from Oliver and his sister wind up pushing
her
to
another. Wait a minute. Sir Ralph Richardson?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Curtis Harrington was like this great sort of like, he did, is it High Tide? Which did the Dennis Hopper movie from the 60s. That's kind of the High Tide or Low Tide or...
Yes, I know the name, Curtis Harrington.
And he was very much in the sort of like...
Ryan, help us out.
The kind of Hollywood witchcraft circle. Like, apparently...
I've got to see Who Slew Annie Rue.
Lisa Jane Persky wrote this amazing article about Curtis Harrington's funeral where Kenneth Anger got up and claimed that Harrington had, like, summoned a Dybbuk or something. He was very into the sort of L.A. seance scene.
Yeah, that one sounds really...
Night Tide.
Night Tide, thank you. I knew there was a tide in there somewhere.
Yes.
Wow, that one sounds really good. Okay, now we're going to get into the worst. Like, what? What qualified? Were there more that you had to leave out?
Well, there have been more since the book came out. I'll say that.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, the year.
I love the picture you had. It's crazy.
You
had a funny, very funny picture.
That's from
here.
The 1959 Mexican Santa Claus.
I mean, that is great. I don't know if they can see that.
The more I see that movie, I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome setting in, but like I kind of think now that it's maybe kind of brilliant. But it's a low budget movie from the guy who's
hysterical,
probably best known in this country for directing a movie called Wrestling Women versus the Aztec Mummy, and it's all about Santa, and you know, he fights a demon from hell named Pitch, whom the devil has sent to Earth to stop Christmas, but Santa has Merlin on his side. It's bonkers.
Wow.
But it's a lot of fun. But yeah, I think I was also trying to pick like movies that were bad,
sort
but
of kitschy,
but fun to watch.
Yeah.
So it's like Santa Claus the movie, I think, is really bananas, but also has this insane scenery chewing performance by John Lithgow that you just have to see. And then there's the Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny and the Magic Christmas Tree, which is these like really super, super low budget movies from the 60s that you just don't even know where they came from. Like the Magic Christmas Tree, when I did the research, every single person in that movie was the only credit they have on IMDb. Like the director, the producer, the writer, the cast, like nobody ever did anything else, but they all somehow made this one wackadoo movie.
One and done.
So this one, get yourself a college girl. I mean, like, how did you even find it?
IMDb gives you categories sometimes.
Oh,
you know?
I see.
I would chase things down. Yeah, Get Yourself a College Girl is one of those sort of like teen dance party movies.
I love movies like that's a theme I love. Oh my God,
yeah.
Dance movies. That's I'm in.
They all
Chad Everett's in it.
Chad Everett's in it. Nancy Sinatra's in it. They go to a ski slope, and you know the animals and the Dave Clark Five sing. And I think it's the only movie Astrid Gilberto performs in, so you get to see her sing "Girl from Ipanema."
Hairstyles by Sidney Gerloff.
Yes,
and
boy howdy are their hairstyles. Marianne Mobley, I think, is the star.
Actually. Yeah.
Future Miss America.
Oh, and the producer was Sam Katzman.
Yes,
so he was like a legendary. Did all sorts of low budget, you know, kind of films here.
Yeah, he was one of the early exploitation kings.
Santa and the Ice Cream. I'm just going to go through them because they're all so crazy. Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny.
Yeah, it was made
no
for...
writer credited.
Yeah, exactly. Because nobody wanted to. It was made as a tie-in for some like little theme park in Florida that got destroyed when Disney opened, basically.
Yeah.
And there's a whole chunk in the middle of the movie. And depending... This is how, like... Fly by night. This is some versions in the middle of it. There's this whole performance of Thumbelina, but in a little amusement park theater. And then in other versions, it's some other fairy tale. I forget which now. But again, I think the producer behind that had made all these like really tacky sounding like 60s sex movies, and then Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny.
Yeah. Oh my God! And then you have 6 weeks in there.
Oh, that one's hilarious.
Yeah,
There is something about a precocious child dying of leukemia after showing zero symptoms for the entire movie that is just like comedy gold.
And Dudley Moore is in it.
Yeah, Dudley Moore and Mary Tyler Moore,
Wow.
who are both hot off of like Arthur and Ordinary People, respectively.
Yeah.
And that movie completely like killed their career momentum.
Wow.
Oh my God. The 6 weeks is, I have to read this, so funny. 6 weeks is the sort of film where dying of leukemia equals being completely healthy until that moment when the patient wails, "It hurts!" before suddenly dropping dead.
That is what happens in 6 weeks. Then that's not a spoiler. That's an inducement to watch it.
Yeah. No, that one is, you know, that one is the... There's so many great ones. I'm gonna put it down.
But I have a whole Scrooge chapter. Like there are so many
versions.
Yeah. You know,
is that the one that's been the most?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the most adapted piece of literature in the movies ever. Like even more than Hamlet or whatever. And, you know, and you see these sort of these trends that happen. Like, there was a while there in the 90s where it was all Scrooge is an ambitious career woman.
Right.
You know, so you had your Susan Lucci version and your Cicely Tyson and your Vanessa Williams and your Tori Spelling.
Yeah.
And like, but then you also have your musicals and you have your animated ones and, like, so many.
I know. And they had The Businessman.
Yeah.
I wonder what the current Scrooge would be. I guess, you know, anti-climate or something.
Well, that's true. Yeah, probably somebody who, like, runs an oil company or something. But, you know, yeah. I mean, Scrooge at least made him a TV executive. You know, that was a fun spin on it. But, yeah, I mean, it is endlessly permeable. There's something almost sort of like passion play about Scrooge where the story is in our DNA. Mm-hmm. We know all the beats of it. And so now it's just a question of changing the specifics and the particulars.
I think that's sort of part of the fun of Christmas movies, too, is that you know them so well. And,
yeah.
You know.
I always joke about the Hallmark movies that if you fall asleep in the middle of one and wake up in the middle of the next one, you will still know what's happening and what's about to happen.
That's true. There's a few they've been doing shooting a few of them in Connecticut because it's a little picturesque. And then most of it they do in Vancouver.
In Vancouver, yeah.
90%. And then
in the lower 48, I'm very excited to hear.
Yeah. There used to be a town where I grew up that, and unfortunately it went out of business, but some wealthy people literally bought the entire town and turned it into like a Christmas town.
Ugh.
So it was really nice to go visit there. But
my favorite thing about Hallmark movies is figuring out which actor they're like the B-minus version of. Like, I feel like they all have like their doppelganger that they could probably be a stand-in for.
Yes.
Like, it's like, oh, we couldn't get Brad Pitt, so we got, or like, oh, we couldn't get, because they all vaguely look like
people.
In general, actors are very attractive people, right? But it's always fun to figure out, like, who could you have been or who do you audition with?
Well, that's kind of like Christian pop music. You can sort of, like, correlate, well, which secular band is this supposed to be the equivalent
totally,
of?
Totally, yeah.
You know, but you're not allowed to listen to A, so we're going to give you B.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Jeff, do you have any? I wrote down some of my favorites. I mean, I hated to put Wonderful Life as number one, but what else?
Well, I think
I did too.
My controversial choice is I'm a big Sean Baker fan who did most recently The Florida Project, which is a movie that our listeners have probably definitely seen.
Yeah.
But he made a movie like 5 years ago now called Tangerine.
Oh, Tangerine.
Yeah, shot all on iPhone, starring two trans actors playing trans actors, which is great because that does not happen enough.
Right.
And really wonderful performances. That's a really interesting movie, very kinetic, very energetic movie. And I'd call it a Christmas film. It takes place on Christmas Eve.
It's set entirely on Christmas Eve.
Yep.
Also, one of the rare movies that really gets its LA geography right.
Yes.
Like, it is set in this conscribed area, and it all, like, I always know where they are, and it always makes sense that they could have done it on foot or on the bus or whatever it is they're doing.
It all adds up, totally.
And it all winds up at the Hamburger Mary's that is right around the corner from my house. So,
we all live in WeHo, actually. I think we're pretty geographically close to each other.
Yeah, and I recognize a lot of things.
Yeah, it's like, it's an LA that I know. It's funny. I feel like LA so often is portrayed as like the first class privileged LA.
Sure.
But I really like seeing a movie that's like about the corner of, what would that be, Santa Monica and Highland, right? And there used to be the donut time. I think it's a Trejo's Tacos now, but
no, it's Trejo's Coffee and Donuts.
Oh, that's right, Trejo's Donuts. But yeah, I feel like it's really nice to see that version of LA because it's very much an LA that most people who live here actually know.
Yeah, and they get the LA light right too, which again, you're shooting an iPhone, so you really have no choice. But I think that's what the title refers to, is just that color of the sky.
Yeah, certainly. But I really like that movie. I love Sean Baker in general. And that there's a Christmas Carol karaoke moment in that movie that I feel like is one of those iconic sort of Christmas song moments for me in that movie. So that would be my kind of obscure pick. I have that at number five.
What? Oh, that's what you're... For my number five, I put Christmas in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
I just love it. For the sort of screwball, and it's about a woman. I guess she's sort of like the Martha Stewart of her day, right? And she writes in for a magazine about being the perfect hostess, and it's all fake. She's not married. She
lives in an apartment.
Yeah. So this GI, Dennis Morgan, is coming home from the war, and they think it would be a great idea for him. Oh, there it is. And of course, she falls in love with him. Then she has to explain. There's a lot of odd scenes with the baby in that.
Yeah, well, there's a thing where they're borrowing somebody's baby, but they don't borrow the same baby every day, so it changes gender at some point.
Yeah, that's like the one part that, you know, when you're watching movies, you're like, okay, I'm just going to let that go.
There's a subgenre of Christmas movies where Barbara Stanwyck is a terrible journalist, because, like, meet John Doe. The movie begins with her getting fired, and then she writes this column about a fake guy, and then
it's one of the weird scenes, actually, with the baby.
The baby, and there's a whole thing about can she flip a flapjack, and you know, that's a fun movie though.
But it's still fun again about, you know, the pressure of the holidays and it all. Even though everything is chaos, it all sort of turns out okay. And
it does say something about like where America was in the 1940s that you could open a comedy with a U.S. troop ship getting sunk and only two people surviving, and that's the initiating incident of a comedy.
Oh my God!
My number five. This is actually a recent one that is fun and a horror movie that I did enjoy, even though again, wimp. Called Better Watch Out, and it's sort of the idea of if the kid from Home Alone were a little older and you know not fully acknowledging how much of a sadist that he is, but he's like, you know, there are home invaders, there's a babysitter, he's trying to protect them. Things get complicated, and there are some really fun twists. It's a really cool movie.
Oh, okay. Great. I'm going to look that one out.
Again, you mentioned it earlier, Die Hard, of course, is a Christmas film. I have that as my number four. It's funny, I only saw Die Hard for the first time 3 years ago, and I feel like I've always resisted that movie because it so often gets referenced as like the iconic action film, right? And so I feel like sometimes I have a resistance if I feel like something is overhyped or over-referenced.
Of course,
I feel like I watched it kind of begrudgingly expecting to find it to be an overrated film, and I finished it and thought, like, well, that's a pretty perfect movie.
Yeah. It's the Casablanca of 80s action movies.
It's a really great movie.
There's nothing wrong with it. You know?
Totally. It's totally engaging, and it just, talk about ratcheting up tension. Mm. It's sort of a master class of screenwriting, really, is how I view that movie.
Yeah.
So that's my number four. Love Die Hard.
Good choice.
My number four, I did Elf. You know, I love it. I love, you
totally.
Know, it's, it, that was, you know, that's an interesting movie because I remember doing it. I did a talk show with Jon Favreau and Will Ferrell, and they were making the movie.
Oh, funny.
And they were very nervous about it.
Is this the Table for Five?
Or? Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
And so I remember it was summer and they were making this movie and, you know, they were like, I don't know, this thing's going to work, you know?
Well, what's great about Elf is like it has such a high wire act between being kind of knowing and ironic and being completely sort of ingenuous.
Yeah.
Which I think is a lot of comedies try and fail to make that happen. Mm. And they make that, they get right in there.
I think it rests on the commitment of everybody, you know, because you're putting on those costumes, you know, again, like it was interesting, you know, talking to Will Ferrell because he was like, I don't know about this thing, you know, like, but then when I saw it on screen, it's that, I mean, the commitment to it, it just, you just go with it.
Yeah,
you know?
They're not putting it in quotes. Like,
no.
They're just doing it.
Everybody, I mean, you know, even, well, I love James Caan in anything, so, you know, just like seeing James Caan and Ed Asner.
Yeah.
Was that the beginning of Ed Asner's Santa?
Oh, I think he'd already done some Santas on TV. Yeah, he's one of the greats.
Who's the best Santa?
I don't like the movie, but I love Paul Giamatti as Santa in Fred Claus.
Mm.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I don't know who I guess I have to.
You
go
know,
with
I mean Edmund O'Brien, no, no, but Edmund Gwen rather.
Edmund Gwen's a good Santa.
Tim Allen's a good Santa.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a bunch.
You know what I just realized? I did a Christmas movie.
Which one?
My God. I think I did it at home. I totally forgot. It was called A Country Christmas.
Oh, wow.
It was completely financed by Brooks and Dunn.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was like Country and the
were
Rascal.
Were they in it? Or?
I think people they knew were in it, but the Rascal Flatts were in it.
Oh, nice.
It was an excuse to get country music. In
oh,
it.
Wow.
Oh, there it is.
I bet it pops up on, you know, the Hallmark. Hallmark has three channels doing Christmas 24/7, so somebody is showing it.
And I only really did it, you know, Kevin Pollak and I have been cast together. And it's just we're our own, you know, William Powell and William. We've been cast opposite each other. We're like, shall we make it five? You know, But anyway, it was fun, and I got to end up in a dung heap. So you're the villain.
Okay,
I was
cool.
The villain.
Perfect.
Yeah. So it was great.
Well, because you're a city lady, and so clearly,
would you be the Scrooge of that movie if you were unredeemed at the end? Technically,
I was unredeemed. I got my comeuppance. Oh, okay. We want to stamp out Christmas. Me and Kevin Pollak.
Foiled.
Yeah, we're foiled. I end up in a dung heap at the end. I know Ryan's trying to desperately find it.
It's not an episode of our podcast if Ileana doesn't accidentally realize or remember that she was actually in a movie she forgot she was in.
It happens all the time.
It's the best. I love
totally.
It.
Totally. I'm like, yeah. I would be like
that.
Johnny Weissmuller suddenly yelling out Tarzan on my deathbed. Okay, is there number four? We're on our number three?
My number four is The Silent Partner, which is a caper movie with Elliot Gould and Susanna York. And Christopher Plummer plays like the most terrifying bank robber who dresses as Santa Claus but gets outfoxed by Elliot Gould. Curtis Hanson screenplay.
Oh, my God. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it came out on Blu-ray this year, so check it out.
Okay, that's a good one.
Right, I'm going to get in trouble because my number three is The Family Stone.
Okay.
I love Diane Keaton always. It's
well,
funny.
Sure, yeah.
You were talking about Christmas movies that aren't necessarily Christmas movies, but to your family they are because you watch them.
Right.
The Diane Keaton, Steve Martin, Father of the Bride is that for our family.
Oh, okay.
It's been that for just probably two decades, really. We watch it every year. So Diane Keaton almost feels like, in a weird way, like my aunt or something. So when she shows up, it always will.
You want to see her at Christmas time.
I want to see her at Christmas time. So that's part of the reason I love The Family Stone. And that movie also introduced the dysfunctional family dramedy for me. Like kind of marked that as a benchmark for my own cinematic taste and loving family movies. So it's not a perfect film. There are some tonal issues, but it's... I do find when it's at its most earnest, it works for me. So
fair enough.
I'll say The Family Stone.
Okay.
All right. My number three, I'm cheating. I got to do a tie. It's sort of a tie because I had to get Holiday Inn in there because I love Holiday Inn and Bing Crosby. And I love the idea of having a nightclub that only is open. It's like, what's the business plan exactly of that? It's a nightclub and it's only open on holidays. But it does have White Christmas in it, and I love it. It's a that's a movie that I always watch
Maybe fast forward through the blackface scene. But,
apart from the Abraham, with them singing Abraham,
right?
Yes.
I had to kind of sneak in Love Actually. Oh, okay. I don't know, but it's in there because it's not with my two and my one. But I do love. That Love Actually, too, is a movie that if it's on, I watch it.
Gotcha. Yeah. My number three is this is a movie that you and I talked about at Christmas Con. It's called I'll Be Seeing You, another one that I had never heard of in the book. So it's Joseph Cotten and Ginger Rogers. He is coming home from World War II with shell shock, as they called it at the time. She is currently in prison for having murdered her boss who tried to rape her and gets like a Christmas sort of furlough to go home.
Yeah.
They meet on a train. Neither of them tells the other one what they're actually about.
Yeah.
He's going out into the world to see if he can still function in the real world or if he needs to just institutionalize himself. And so they're both very broken people, but they meet at the right time and kind of help each other out. And it's quite lovely. And for a 40s movie, like it gets into some like dark stuff that you wouldn't expect. And then Shirley Temple, again, like Deanna Durbin playing one of her first grown-up roles.
That sounds terrific.
Who's like begins being very super judgmental about Ginger Rogers and then kind of comes to understand why she's in jail and stuff. It's really good.
Wow, that sounds great.
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I know. I haven't seen that. I love finding out about new movies. I'll be searching on YouTube or Prime.
Yes. My number two, it's funny, we haven't talked about it as much as I expected to, but I love A Christmas Story.
And
I feel like
I guess it's so obvious. Yeah.
It's an obvious choice, but I'm from Cleveland, you can't not love that movie. And just that, again, you think about really earnestly funny Christmas movies.
Yeah.
That it's a nice balance between kind of sweet and whimsical, but it is pretty funny. That leg lamp scene always plays for me, no matter when I see it or how I see it. So,
right.
I'd put "You'll Shoot Your Eye Out" at least in my personal top 100 quotes for films, and I love it.
I was just having a conversation with somebody about how, you know, like, we're getting these sequels to Avatar, and Avatar was the highest grossing film of all time. Nobody quotes Avatar,
yeah,
and nobody has, like, Avatar merch, but, you know, we say "You'll Shoot Your Eye Out," and people have the leg lamp, and, like,
yeah,
that movie has so bled into the culture in a way that, like, much more successful movies don't.
So true. Yeah, I can't think of anything really iconic about Avatar. It's strange. I mean, even narratively, that's a pretty derivative movie.
Mm.
And I like James Cameron a lot, but
no, it was breathtaking to see it in 3D. And I'm not, it's no shade,
yeah,
on the movie, but it's just, it doesn't, you know, usually movies that have come to have an impact, like even like Titanic, like you, if you say "I'm King of the World" or "Draw Me Like Your French Girls," like people know what you're talking about.
Right.
Right.
Nobody quotes Avatar.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, I think more of Ben Stiller at the Oscars, which I did think was one of the funniest.
Oh, my
that
gosh.
Was a great bit.
Yeah,
making fun. That was a shocker.
That's the best thing Avatar has produced.
There you go.
Is that moment at the Oscars?
In my mind.
Yeah.
Okay, number two. I'm going with Shop Around the Corner.
Oh, great one.
I God, what a beautiful film that is.
Yes.
I love that movie. And Margaret Sullivan, again, she's not in too many films, so
yeah,
whenever she is, you really sort of savor it. She had such an interesting quality.
Yeah, she had. She like, you can sense other actresses going for that same thing that she's doing and not quite nailing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was sort of sophisticated, but she could also be like, you know, the gal from the country or whatever,
yeah,
you know. But yeah, but smart and funny, and yeah, I love her stuff.
Yeah, interesting quality. And like, again, not quite perfect. I think that's why she works so well in the movie, you know. She's not
relatable.
Yeah, mm. She's not glammed up, or it's not Barbara Stanwyck. She was just particularly right for that, you know, for
the
that
shock
film.
Girl.
And he always uses all the little character actors. I love,
yes,
how they pop up in all of his films.
Yeah. No, like, if you want to sort of introduce somebody to Ernst Lubitsch and why he's special and great, like, that's the movie to show him, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But I if that's on at Christmas.
Mm.
I watched that. When I was a kid, I did love Bishop's Wife, though.
That's a good one, too.
I haven't seen it in a while.
It holds up pretty well.
It does.
I mean, it's weird.
I didn't see the remake.
It's weird because there's this sort of, like, almost romantic undercurrent to, like, Cary,
yes,
Grant and Loretta Young. But it's like, she's married and you're dead, and, you know. But it works. It works, you know.
That's another theme. I do love women in love with ghosts.
Oh, okay.
That right. seemed to be really,
yeah,
popular.
Ghost of Mrs. Muir. And
yes.
That's you know, probably because World War II, and, you know,
right,
a lot of widows.
I think that's true.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. What's my excuse?
My number two is the 1970 musical version of Scrooge with Albert Finney.
Oh, yes.
I love that one.
That's a great one.
He's one of my favorite Scrooges. He's one of the only,
yes,
actors who plays old Scrooge and young Scrooge, which I think,
right,
is kind of cool. So, like, you see him old, and he's got the old age makeup, and he's, you know, all cruel and greedy and whatever. But then there's
that's
the flashbacks. It's like hot Albert Finney,
yeah,
you know, and you're thinking, oh, man, how did that guy become this guy, you know? And, yeah, I like the songs. I'm a Leslie Bricus fan from way back.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, yeah, it's just, it's you know, I think there are a lot of great ones, you know, the George C. Scott and Alistair Sim, and but the Muppets, but I love Scrooge.
I am a sucker just for any, you know, Scrooge, the Bill Murray, the Christmas Carol, they're all,
yeah,
they're my favorite sort of, that's my favorite genre.
It's comfort food, but it's Dickens, so you're allowed to feel smart while you watch
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
It's Christmas!
Yes. My
why
number one
Christmas Day?
Yeah. It's incredibly obvious, but I'm going to Home Alone. That's it for me. That is
yeah.
Christmas for me.
Believe me, it was tough between Home Alone for me too. Home
yeah.
Alone / It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, I mean, that movie. It just, I think partly I was born the year that movie came out. So
oh, wow.
like, and that was, people talk about that movie not only being a cultural Christmas film, but just like a cultural phenomenon in general. So I feel like the way the stars aligned with just my age in that movie, and
mm-hmm.
You know, I just think you can't really outdo it. No movie feels more Christmassy to me, and I'm always so incredibly moved when he sees his mom. That
yeah.
movie for
mm-hmm.
me just there's certain scenes that you'll just always cry when you see him. And the fact that they wrote that he would see his mother first just always touches me so much in that film. So,
yeah.
Home Alone, the strangest thug movie ever made.
I wonder if you'd be able to, I mean, it's such an obvious thought, but it's like, again, would you be able to make a movie like that today where they'd say, it's horrible.
They can't leave this child.
They just announced they're doing a new version for Disney Plus.
Oh, they are?
With one of the kids from Jojo Rabbit. Yeah, so we'll see. My first thought was, so he's going to have no internet and no cell phone, right? Because
no.
Otherwise, it's a five-minute movie.
Facebook status. He tweets out, please help.
Exactly. I'm home alone.
The end.
Yeah. He TikToks his...
It's got the great, the Daniel Stern and Joe Pesci really make the movie. They're fantastic villains. I mean, again, I keep thinking of this theme, like, you've got to commit to a Christmas movie.
Yes.
150%.
Yeah.
You know, in an almost cartoon, you know.
Yeah, because if Home Alone didn't go for it, it would have been a mess. That movie wouldn't. It only works because of how broadly it's drawn, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that was such a hit. It inspired so many knockoffs that didn't work. And so you can sort of pick out, okay, well, this didn't do that one. And, you know, the things that Home Alone gets right that so many other movies get wrong.
Interesting. Yeah.
I went with It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it's just because it's a movie that, although there's so many times I've seen it, but it always gets to me. And again, like you said, whatever is going on with him emotionally, it just works so much. And that scene where he comes home and he's irritated with everybody. And where he comes from where they, you know, where they start out. I think it's a really truthful depiction of how you can feel around the holidays, the pressure of not having any money and not being able to get presents and, you know, all those kind of things and what's really important and what, you know.
Nathan Rabin just wrote this amazing piece about now that he's a father, that scene that you talk about where he's all irritated, but then when he like grabs his youngest son and like starts weeping, he goes, that scene kills him now.
Yes.
That it's just like it's become so powerful. But yeah, I you know, every time I watch it, even though I've seen this movie a million times, I know everything that's going to happen when Uncle Billy loses that money. My whole inside start collapsing. Like, oh God, no! And I just know the next 45 minutes is just going to be agony, and then I'm going to be rewarded with like the greatest happy ending in the history of movies. But they make you earn it every single time.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's true. I always get upset too with poor Gloria Graham because she's always Gloria Graham becomes
Violet Bick.
Yeah, she becomes a prostitute, and I think that's a really interesting too. That they really again commit to this idea that of thinking about if you weren't here, what would happen, and that you all, you know, we all have some importance
to somebody.
Yeah, beyond, like, you didn't have to go off and be a war hero. And I think it's important to kind of think about that as, you know.
Especially in this business, right?
A Christmas. And I love the dancing scene, too. I think that's magical, you know, another.
An actual, you know, that's the floor of the Beverly Hills High Gym.
Yeah.
Which really does that. There is a pool.
Is it the Venice High School or is it Beverly Hills?
I think it's Beverly Hills.
Okay. Yeah. Nice.
And it's funny because then, you know, the Marlo Thomas did a made-for-TV remake of it in the 70s where she was the George Bailey character.
Oh, God.
There's a lot going on in that movie, but they shot it in the same place so they could do the thing again.
The old switcheroo.
Yeah.
And, of course, Lionel Barrymore. He's the classic when you think of a Christmas villain.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
How many Mr. Potters?
And a Happy New Year in jail. He had been. He did a radio version of Scrooge every year that had become really popular, and that was sort of why he got cast in that role.
He's perfect. I can't imagine.
It's like what you're saying with the Lubitsch, the ensemble of that movie. Like he populates that town with so many great faces, with like Thomas Mitchell and Beulah Bondi, and like you know, and so many of those are become like. You know, the sort of fabric of American movies of that era. So, like, that whole small town just kind of feels like it is populated with all these people that we know because we've seen them so many times before.
I also like the idea, too. Frank Capra would always have, like, you know, Mr. Macaroni. Oh, and you know, it's always like,
Martini.
Yeah, Mr. Martini.
But yeah, it's like, I'm a broader stereotype.
You know, getting the housing for the This is holy, you know, we're learning. I remember when I was a kid, like, it just seemed so scary, this idea that you could lose your house and what, this own bank. And then in a weird way, this happened.
Yeah, I know. This actually happened. So much of history repeats itself in so many of Capra movies, like Meet John Doe. When I was doing the book, like, you have this whole thing where, like, there's this grassroots movement of people, and they're just sort of like looking out for their neighbors and taking care of each other. And then Edward Arnold sweeps in as this like awful business guy who wants to like take it over and use it for nefarious purposes. And when I saw that movie, it was when like the Koch brothers were coming in and creating all those like fake town hall things for people to fight against the Affordable Care Act. And I was like, it's all happening again.
Oh, God. It's hard. Well, it's good to have Christmas movies this time of year because, you know, we certainly need.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's becoming hard? You know, again, it's hard to reinvent the Christmas film when things are. What is left? What do you think is left?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that we've been seeing in the last few years is that because Hallmark and Lifetime have really taken over so much of the space, that movies that open theatrically kind of have to figure out, well, what can we do that's different?
Right.
And so you've been seeing more like movies with all or mostly black casts because those aren't happening so much on Lifetime. You're seeing like the R-rated Christmas movies, whether they're horror movies or comedies, because it's like, well, you're not going to get this on TV. We can push the boundaries a little more. So I think there's always a response to like, well, you're already getting this. Let's try this, you know?
Right.
And so I think it's a flexible enough genre that, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to go about it.
I feel like that the one thing you could try again is the road trip movie, like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because that is, I think that's still really relatable. Like that day that you put down your work gear and, you know, you get on the flight or whatever and you go home and there's just that.
And it's winter. So like in certain parts of the country, like the roads are going to be messed up or, you know, your engine's not going to deal with the cold. Well, like, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of half of it writes itself in terms of just the time and place.
Have there been any just specifically gay Christmas films?
Well, interestingly, there's one this year that it's streaming. It's called Season of Love. Mm-hmm. That they're really kind of aiming at the sort of Hallmark market.
Oh my God, a totally gay Hallmark movie.
It's lesbian. It's a three lesbian couples, but it's otherwise very much in the kind of Hallmark tradition. I even sort of jokingly, I told the filmmaker, I said, I noticed you included the empty coffee cups. Every time, like, someone's like, oh, hey, I brought coffee, the cardboard cup with the plastic lid, and you know there's nothing in it because it was just waving around like crazy. But anyway, Season of Love, it's very charming. I want there to be more of them. I think that's a niche that's waiting to be occupied. There have been a few attempts over the years of a movie called Make the Yuletide Gay and the comedy that I like a lot called Breakfast with Scott. But yeah, I think we're really waiting for like a really good one.
Kind of Rent, right?
Rent, I mean, it is a Christmas movie and it is gay inclusive, but, you know, I think we're stretching it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think entirely gay families with their kids would be
just
a funny.
Think of the sweaters.
Just the whole, I think that would be funny. That would be, I mean, I would laugh. Anyway.
You know, I think you could do a Christmas in Connecticut with like, you know, where it's like one of the Queer Eye guys who's supposed to be like good at cooking or whatever. And it turns out he's been faking it all along.
I think that would be, you know,
that's a great pitch.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's our idea. We're copyrighting it.
Yes.
Anyway. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Getting us in the spirit. Now I'm excited. You mentioned so many good movies to see.
Well, I hope that when people pick up the book, they have a highlighter and they, you know,
go get it on Amazon.
Like, it sends you to chase down some movies you haven't seen before. So
it does. There's certainly a bunch. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes, we had Alonzo Duralde on. Of course, Alonzo, you have a couple podcasts, Linoleum Knife, which you do with your husband. And then you're doing a podcast over Maximum Fun, Who Shot You, right?
Who Shot You, right.
That's Ify Nwadiwe, you and
Drea Clark.
Yes, and Drea Clark. And what else? What else can we find you?
And then Breakfast All Day, which is, I used to do a show on TYT called What the Flick, and then they got rid of all their non-political shows. So Christy Lemire and Matt Atchity and our mutual friend Ben Mankiewicz and I decided to like keep the band together. So now we're doing Breakfast All Day. It's a podcast, and you can catch us on YouTube.
Oh, and speaking of podcasts, guys, it would mean a lot if you guys could hop on iTunes and give us the Apple Podcasts now is what we're officially supposed to call it. But give us those 5 stars. It really means a lot.
Five.
I've been seeing more reviews come in, and it really means a lot. And when we see reviews we love, we do read them on air. So keep bringing those. And, of course, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel here at The Popcorn Talk. And exciting show next week, Ileana.
Yes, our friend Larry Karaszewski. Yes. We're going to be going to him live and talking about Dolomite, which is... one of my favorite films of the year.
Definitely.
God, I love that film so much. I'm so happy for him. So we're going to be talking to him next week. And then we're going to be home watching Christmas movies for the rest of the time. But anyway, thank you again, everyone, so much for listening in. And we enjoy all of your comments. As we always end the show, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Today was a Christmas movie. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeff. So long.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.